This is continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill from the Hidden Killers podcast.
Hidden Killers podcast.
We are up to the fourth segment of our continuous coverage in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybill. Let's go to the courtroom.
Your Honor, the state calls Nick Balance.
Counselor, before you conduct your direct examination, I'll just ask the witness, now they've been placed under oath, have you reviewed or listened to any of the trial testimony in this case before testifying today?
No, Your Honor, I have not.
All right, thank you. With that in mind, then, please make sure to make verbal responses to any questions you're asked and try to avoid talking at the same time as any attorney asking you questions so we can keep a clear record of the case. With those rules in mind, Mr. Wood, if you'd like to inquire on your direct, you may.
Thank you. Will you please state your name and spell your last name for the record?
Certainly. My name is Nicholas Balance, spelled B-A-L-L-A-N-C-E.
Thank you. How are you employed?
I'm a special agent with the FBI.
Okay. And how long have you worked as a special agent for the FBI?
Since June of 2016.
And where are you assigned?
So I'm assigned to the Boise, Idaho Resident Agency out of the Salt Lake City Division.
Prior to being a special agent with the FBI, were you previously employed in law enforcement?
I was. I served as a deputy U.S. Marshal with the U.S. Marshal Service for approximately 9 years.
Are you a member of a specialized unit within the FBI?
Yes, sir. I'm a certified member of the Cellular Analysis Survey Team, or CAST for short.
What kind of work does CAST do?
In a very broad sense, CAST takes cellular records and geolocation records and puts those onto a map so we can look at where a phone was located either historically or where a phone is located now.
Okay. And have you used those techniques successfully in the past?
Yes.
Okay. What kind of cases have you used this technology in?
So hundreds of cases to include, you know, fugitive investigations, homicide investigations, missing kids, and in general just cases where it's important to know where an individual's phone was during a specific date and time that might be of interest to an investigation.
Did you do similar work when you were with the U.S. Marshals?
Yes, sir, I did.
And how long have you been a member of CAST?
Since October of 2019.
And do you assist other agencies with this type of analysis?
Yes. So I'll routinely assist other federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies, as well as I've assisted search and rescue in the past as well.
How do these investigators or other agents contact you?
So as a member of CAST, I do a significant amount of teaching and outreach to different prosecutors' offices and other law enforcement agencies in the area and throughout the United States. So an individual could have met me at one of those trainings and could reach out for assistance on a case, or people can also reach out through our unit, and then our unit would assign cases to individuals that are usually in the same geographic area.
And how many members does CAST have nationwide?
It fluctuates, but approximately 70 to 80 nationwide.
And how does one get selected to be a part of CAST?
So there's an application process for anyone that has interest in being a part of the program. And so if your application is accepted, there's multiple trainings that you would go to. The first three vary between a couple of days and a week in length, and they basically start with learning how to take records and put those onto a map. The first iterations of training are very instructor-led. There's a lot of teaching points, whereas when you get to the third piece of that training, it's more of you're given a problem, and you have to work that problem out, map out those records, and then provide the solution, and then that's graded. So if you complete those three pieces of training, then you would go to our four-week certification process. So that includes lectures specific from the different major providers, from their legal compliance people, as well as their network engineers talking about how their networks work, how their records work, as well as instruction in radio frequency theory from university professors. And then we also get instruction on what's called drive testing, which I can speak to a little bit more later if asked. But drive testing, learning how that works. And then at the conclusion, we get a practical exam where we have to take a case and work it start to finish, as well as traditional written exams that we have to pass.
Okay. When you complete that training and those written examinations, are you considered to be certified?
Yes.
With regards to the Rexburg, Idaho area, how many primary companies operate cellular networks?
Primarily three. It would be T-Mobile, Verizon, and AT&T, and then historically Sprint as well prior to them merging with T-Mobile.
Okay. And do they all operate independent of one another?
Yes, they do.
What does that mean in terms of cell towers?
So basically what that means is if you have a T-Mobile phone and you're paying your bill to T-Mobile and utilizing their network, your phone's going to utilize the T-Mobile network. And even though an AT&T tower might be very near your house, your phone would utilize that T-Mobile tower, providing coverage to you, your phone.
Okay. We talked about cell towers. What specifically do cell towers do?
So from a broad sense, if you think about, I'll speak in a lot of analogies just to kind of explain things. But if you think about your phone as being a radio that you could go get from an electronics store, and so you have two of them and you can communicate back and forth on those two-way radios. So the problem becomes is those radios aren't powerful enough to go, you know, say from Boise all the way to Rexburg. So that's where your cellular network comes in. So if you think about that radio or your phone, it's going to communicate with a cell tower. And so those cell towers are going to be placed throughout a particular city, throughout a particular area. And what it's going to allow it to do is that radio can then take that call or text message, whatever it is you're trying to send out, and put it onto the traditional telecommunications network through that tower. So if I were sitting here with a two-way radio, I wouldn't be able to talk to my buddy, say, in Rexburg, because it's just not going to transmit that far. But with a cell phone, I can transmit to that cellular tower, and then it can route that call to the person that I'm trying to reach that might be a great distance away.
What is the range of a cell tower?
So it varies. Typically, you'll see it follow the population of a particular area. So as an example, here in downtown Boise, you're going to see towers a lot closer together because they're providing coverage to a lot more cell phones just because there's a larger population here. Whereas if you get out into the more rural areas out in the counties or even over to Rexburg, you'll see that those towers will provide coverage to a much larger area away from where they're located.
And our cell towers responsible for providing coverage to a particular area?
Yes. Generally, what the cell phone company is going to do is they're going to aim the antennas on that tower to provide coverage to a specific area.
If I use the word sector in relation to a cell tower, what does that mean?
So if you think about that cell phone tower, and let's say that we're looking at it directly above it, and we're looking straight down at that cell phone tower. So typically what the provider is going to do is they're going to hang the different antenna that they're utilizing for that tower, and they're going to face them in different directions to provide that coverage. So a traditional tower is going to have three sides or three sectors. What that means is basically there's going to be sets of antenna that are facing three different directions. So whenever we talk about a sector, again, going back to an analogy, if you're looking from the top, think about that tower as a pizza, a whole pizza. You're dividing that pizza into three equal parts, and each one of those equal parts would be representative of a sector for that particular tower.
Okay. And can you briefly summarize how a cell phone engages a cell tower.
Sure. So your cell phone, if you have it in your pocket right now, you don't necessarily have to be talking. It's constantly taking a measurement of which towers are in the area and what that signal strength is for each particular tower and a particular sector on that tower. So it's taking those measurements and it's ranking them based on the different cellular technology that it sees at any given time. So whenever you go to make a call out, your phone is going to select the strongest, clearest signal in order to allow that call to happen and communicate with a particular tower. So where that's significant is that your phone is making that decision. It's not the network. Your phone has that measurement going on in the background whenever it decides which tower and sector it's going to utilize whenever it needs to interact with the network.
Okay. Do cellular companies record the activities of their customers?
Yes, they do. And so typically you would see this, several years ago, you would get this in the mail and it would be your call detail record, or CDR for short. And what you would typically see is a copy of your bill and all the activity that you had on it for that particular billing cycle. So you would see the date and time of particular calls that you made or received, the number associated with who you called or who called you, the duration of that call, as well as the type, whether it's a call or text message. So in that call detail record, which you typically wouldn't see if you got that in the paper version or you checked on your account online, is the column that includes the tower and sector that's utilized that would have provided the ability to make that call.
Okay. Cellular companies keep track and a record of which cell towers are being used?
Yes, they do.
Okay. What do you call those records of each customer, which document the cell phone usage history?
So that would be your call detail record.
Okay. And what, to the extent you haven't already answered this, what pieces of information can typically be found in call detail records?
So kind of what I mentioned earlier about your bill, you're going to see the date and time, what call type it was, whether it's a call or text message, whether it was incoming or outgoing, the associated number that you interacted with. And then, as I mentioned, on a call detail record maintained by the provider, you would also see the tower and sector that was utilized during that specific interaction with the network.
Okay. Do cellular providers also maintain lists of where their towers are located?
They do. So specific to any given carrier, they're going to have a list that includes the latitude and longitude location of every tower that they have throughout the United States.
Okay. And so how can you use those records you've been talking about to determine where a phone was located?
So again, if you go back to that tower list, and we have the locations that a provider gives us of where those towers and sectors are located. So we can place all of those on the map, and I give the analogy like placing a bucket on the map. And so if you're looking at, you know, mapping out the towers in Boise, you're placing a bucket at all of those latitude and longitudes. And then I can take a phone, if it's utilized in Boise and utilizing those towers, and every single record that you have is going to have the specific tower and sector that was used. So then you can take each record and drop it into that bucket feasibly. So at that point, you know, if you had just say a day's worth of records, you'd be able to look and see, as long as there's an interaction with the network on that call detail record at specific dates and times, I can estimate a general location of where that phone would have been whenever that particular interaction occurred.
And you say a general location, what do you mean by that?
Yeah, so whenever I talked a little bit before about the distance that a tower would provide coverage to, what we're looking at is generally a tower provides coverage out to the next tower so that there's overlapping coverage. And whenever you go to make a call, you don't get an error. You actually make the call and it goes through. So because of that, we estimate a tower's and sector's coverage to go out approximately to the next neighboring tower closest to it.
Okay. You mentioned drive testing. What is that?
So drive testing is a technique that is utilized in the cellular industry, and I'll compare it to looking at the weather. So whenever I'm looking at just on a map, and I've mapped out the towers in an area, and I've mapped out, you know, what the coverage I believe to be looked like, That's based on my training and experience of knowing what networks look like, but it's a forecast. Just as the weatherman can take a lot of different data into his equation and figure out what he anticipates is going to happen with the weather tomorrow. Well, just like we all live in Idaho, we know that can change drastically. So the best way to know what the weather is going to look like would be to walk outside and see, is it raining, is it snowing, whatever it is. So the same thing with a drive test. The drive test is equipment that is taking measurements constantly of the different radio frequency that's being emitted from all the different providers. So we would drive around with that equipment in a vehicle into basically everywhere we anticipate that that tower would provide coverage to, and it's constantly taking those measurements. So once I complete that, then I can put all that onto a map, and I can see the true coverage area of where a particular cell tower and sector provides coverage to versus just what my estimate would be based on looking at the network on a map.
Okay. In the case of the State versus Lori Vallow, did you conduct a drive test?
Yes.
And when was this drive test conducted?
In June of 2020.
Why was it conducted in June of 2020?
So in June of 2020, there were significant developments in the case, and at that time, I traveled to Rexburg, Idaho, and conducted the drive test.
Okay. Now, can the data that's determined by a drive test, can that change over time?
It can, and again, it varies with depending on the location. So for instance, you know, Boise's seen significant population growth in the past few years, so a network... the engineers are constantly going to be looking at particular areas that, say, for instance, they may not have needed to provide coverage to a rural farm that didn't have a neighborhood on it, but that was 2 years ago, and now there's been a completely new development with a bunch of houses that would need service. So you can see things like that happen. Typically in more rural areas, there'll be changes, but they are just not as quick, I would say.
Okay, so in an area the size of Rexburg, would you expect to see significant changes in the results of your drive test data in the space of a year?
No.
Okay. So are you able to determine where a phone was located 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, by identifying the tower and sector it used?
No, because the limitations, like I mentioned, are going to be that we can look at what a tower and sector provides coverage to, but we can't say specifically down to a 1-inch by 1-inch location of where that tower or where that phone is located within that tower and sector. Second to that, all of these mapping of records are going to be based on there has to be a record generated with the provider in order for me to look at a particular date and time and estimate a phone's general location.
Okay. Does a cell phone always select the geographically closest tower?
No, and I mentioned before that it's going to select the strongest and clearest. Typically, that can be the closest tower, but you can have a lot of different obstructions, like, say, a parking structure with a lot of cement in it, or, you know, a mountain in a particular area, to where then the cell phone, it might be closer to that tower, but it's going to select another tower that's providing a stronger, clearer signal.
Okay, but does a phone have to... to collect that data, does it have to be within the coverage area of a tower and sector?
Yes. So in order for a phone to interact with a particular tower and sector, it has to be within the coverage area of that tower and sector and be able to see that radio frequency signal from the tower and sector.
So based on that, regardless of the phone selecting a tower closer or slightly further away, the phone's approximate area can still be estimated, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And you talked earlier about, can you pinpoint the exact location of a phone with cellular records?
No, and it's really based on the specific records that we're looking at of how close we can determine a phone's general area.
Okay. Do you regularly use cellular telephone technology in your work?
Yes, on a daily basis.
You stated earlier, correct, that you provide instruction in the field of historical cell site analysis?
Yes. So I've taught, I believe it's 6 or 7 iterations of our CAST basic class, which is our first class that you would go to if you were interested in the program. And then I've done numerous presentations for law enforcement prosecutors' offices, both in the United States and in Mexico.
Okay. We've been talking about cellular data from cell phones and towers. Does CAST use any other type of records other than that provided by cellular providers?
Yes. So, as you know now, your phones are not just used to make calls and texts. There's numerous applications, communication applications, maps, the internet, things that go on your phone that you can utilize. So, as an example, with a company like Google, so if you're utilizing services from Google, you have a Google account, you can opt in to have your location information stored historically by Google. So typically that's just part of the user experience where you can see locations that you've been in the past, and it's really just dependent on the user if they want to opt in for that. So if a user does opt in, then Google stores that location history in a format that we can utilize to also put onto a map and see where a specific device that was reporting to Google, an estimate of where that device would have been at a specific date and time.
Okay, and what other types of location information can be stored in those records, for example, with Google?
So with Google, it's basically they're going to store the latitude, longitude, the device associated with that particular record, the date and time of the particular record, the margin of error, or how accurate they believe that specific location to be with that data point, and then as well how they sourced that. So typically with Google, there's three types of data that they would source in order to get that location information. GPS, which is looking at satellites and is usually their most precise method of determining a location. Wi-Fi, which doesn't necessarily mean that you connected to a particular Wi-Fi, but it could be that, let's say I'm walking down the street and my phone is constantly looking for Wi-Fi, just like it's constantly looking for the different towers and sectors that would provide service to it. So my phone might see Starbucks, might see McDonald's, but I don't connect to it. But because my phone sees it and Google knows an estimate of where that Wi-Fi emitter is and how close you have to be in order to see that Wi-Fi, they can then estimate a location of where they believe that phone is at that particular date and time. Then the third and final way would be cellular, which we're looking at those records from the provider. So typically the cellular records have a large margin of error. They can be helpful for estimating that a phone was in a particular state, but if we're looking at more specific locations like within a city, they're not usually as helpful just because of that larger margin of error.
So you mentioned latitude and longitude. How is that related to, if I say GPS?
So when you're talking about GPS, you're referring to global position system, looking at satellites that are looking down onto the Earth and giving estimates of the distance away that a particular device is. So when you have multiple satellites, you have multiple measurements of the distance away from those satellites, and you can get more precise location information that way. But whenever we're talking about the latitude and longitude, that's not to be confused with the GPS. Google's reporting all of their location information via that latitude and longitude versus a street address. So it could be three different types. It could be based on GPS, Wi-Fi, or cellular.
Okay, thank you. Between GPS, Wi-Fi, and cellular, to the extent you haven't already addressed this, is there an order in which they are more and least accurate?
Sure. Based on what I've seen with Google records, working it with numerous cases, we typically see the margin of error with GPS is going to be the smallest, Wi-Fi going to be the next in kind of priority of margin of error, and then cellular would usually have the largest margin of error.
Okay. And separate from cellular providers, have you used location information from companies like Google or Facebook successfully in the past?
Yes, I've used it successfully in cases with missing children, with fugitives, with locating suspects.
Okay. Were you asked to examine records in the case of the State versus Lori Vallow?
I was.
Okay. Do you know which records you examined?
So numerous records in this case. It was over 30 cellular phone records as well as multiple Google account records.
Okay. Did you Did you prepare a report that shows your analysis of these records?
I did.
Was your report reviewed by another member of CAST?
Yes. So prior to us submitting a report of looking at all these different records and putting them onto a map, we have another person within our unit that will do a peer review of the report that we're producing. So it would remain in a draft format up until that person who's doing the peer review checks over it and makes sure that all the process and methodology that I'm using is accurate. And then at that point, we would have a final product that would be submitted to whoever was requesting it, in this instance, the prosecutor.
Okay. Your Honor, I realize we took a smaller break earlier. I just wanted to ask if the court was intending on another break or not.
Let me quickly sidebar with counsel, and we'll discuss that.
Okay.
All right, thanks, everyone. In lieu of a break, I think I'd suggest we go about another 30 minutes and then call it an afternoon. Is that fine with the jurors to do that in lieu of a break now? Okay, everybody agrees. So if you want to go ahead and continue with your direct, Mr. Wood.
Thank you. I'd ask that the witness be handed State's Exhibit 156. A disc copy was provided earlier to the court and to counsel. A USB. Do you recognize States 156?
I do.
What is it?
So it's an envelope that I was given earlier that contains a USB drive, which contains a portion of my report.
Okay, and have you reviewed that that USB and that portion of your report?
Yes, I have.
What format is it in?
So it's in a PowerPoint format.
Okay. Upon review of that, did you initial the USB disk?
I did.
Okay. And once you put it in that envelope, did you seal the envelope?
I did.
Did you sign, or did you initial or sign and date over the seal?
Yes, I initialed and dated.
Thank you. Sorry, I should have waited for your answer. And is that envelope in the same condition as when you signed and dated it?
Yes.
The report that's contained in there, you mentioned that you created it after examining multiple cellular records and Google records?
Yes.
Was your report so when you look at the Google records, for example, approximately how many pages of Google records are in the record that you had access to?
So I was looking at the Excel spreadsheet, so I don't know about pages, but it was several hundred thousand lines on that Excel spreadsheet.
Okay, so it's voluminous.
Yes.
Are the cell records, how are they stored? And can you give the jury a size of the quantity of size of one of those records?
So it depends on the particular provider. They can be stored in text format, in PDF, in an Excel format that's readable. And it really just depends on the amount of use of a particular provider and over how long of how lengthy they would be.
Okay. In your report, did you summarize that data for specific dates and times?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And would that summary be helpful to you in testifying to the jury about the records you found for those date and times?
Yes, it would.
When you looked at that USB earlier, was that a true and accurate representation of the slides from your report?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Your Honor, pursuant to Rule 1006, I would ask that State's Exhibit 156 be entered into evidence.
Any objection?
Yes, Your Honor.
Lodge your objection, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would object as to completeness. I understand that the State did provide us with a copy of Exhibit 156, and it does have specific pieces of that report. The report's not that long. I think it's only 100-and-something pages. Let me see. 101 pages. I just asked the court to require the state to submit the entire report and not just the portions that they're requesting.
All right, if you'll give me just a moment, I'm reviewing the rule again. Response to that, Mr. Wood.
Your Honor, the state has picked out the slides it believes are most pertinent for this witness. We can certainly provide the full report, but I would ask that we be able to go ahead with testimony now, and if the court deems it necessary, we can certainly provide the whole report at the end of his testimony.
And I'm okay with that. As long as we get the whole report in, I understand he's probably not going to testify to every page in the report. He's probably only going to testify to the ones that he has there, but I would like the jury to be able to review the entire report, if they wish.
All right, so rule 1006 does cover summaries to prove content, so to be clear then, Exhibit 156 is in fact a summary, it's not the entire report, correct?
Correct.
Okay, well the objection is overruled as it relates to Rule 156. Rule of Evidence 1006 does require that the originals or duplicates be available for examination, and based on the objection of the defense, I would require that the complete report also be provided as an exhibit at some point to correspond with Exhibit 156.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. And we can have that provided by tomorrow, Your Honor. With that, was 156 admitted?
It is admitted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd ask to publish to the jury.
You can publish it.
Your Honor, I'd ask that the witness remove the USB from the sealed.
All right. Based on the foundation laid to submit the exhibit with his testimony, I'll find on the record here that he is allowed to open the sealed envelope and remove the contents, which is a USB jump drive.
Agent, can you explain what's on page 11? I'm just going to, each of these slides, for the purpose of the day, Your Honor, is numbered where it was in the report. I didn't renumber anything, so I'll just refer to the slides by, if it's okay with the court and counsel, the number that's in the upper right-hand corner.
Yes.
Agent, can you describe what's on page 11?
Yes. Page 11 is a part of the report that's basically showing more of a legend and showing how I'm going to be representing call activity whenever it's placed on a map. So I'll start from the top. The different circles, red, green, and blue, are representative of the other towers that are on the map that were not utilized during a particular interaction. Going down the left side, those are all of the different numbers that are included in this report that would be shown on the map. And then whenever I talked before about the sector, so as you can see, looking at the blue wedge per se, there's kind of a half circle on there. That doesn't mean that a phone was located within that shaded in area. That's merely just to show the direction from the tower that that particular interaction took place, like where from the tower the phone was generally located at the time of that interaction. So as you go down, you'll see there's multiple different numbers, and then it has a name associated beside the number that was provided to me. On the call information box, you'll see every time there's a particular interaction that's mapped out, you'll see these boxes, and that's what they represent. So the cell ID is the tower information that lets me know where on the tower list to go to find out where that tower and sector is located in the direction that it's facing. And then you'll see the date and time, the target number specifically that I'm mapping. So I'm pulling records associated with that number from the provider, the start time of a particular interaction, what the type or the direction that it was, being outgoing or ingoing, duration or how long that particular interaction lasted, the type of a call. Typically what you'll see here is voice or text, and then the associated number. So on an outbound call, the associated number would be the number that was called. On an inbound call, the associate number would have called the target number.
Okay. When you talk about duration, what's that measurement? Is that?
That measurement is in seconds.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Can you explain, you spoke earlier about drive test data. Can you explain these graphics to the jury?
Yeah. So this is basically taking what I said and showing the visual representation of that. So you'll see drive test data represented usually one of two different ways. The first way on the left is where you're looking at that darker green area. That's the dominant coverage of a particular tower and sector. So what that means is if a phone is within that dominant area, it's going to prioritize that tower and sector of what it wants to utilize to communicate with the network. The lighter green area is the coverage area. So what that means is if a phone is within that lighter green area, then it could interact with that tower and sector. It has the necessary coverage for it to interact with it. So then on the right side, you're looking at two different towers. So the tower on the top right, which is again represented by that wedge shape, and then the tower on the bottom left. So I'm putting the coverage of two different towers and sectors on a map. And so what you'll see is that orange area, that those are areas where you have overlapping coverage, meaning that a phone can see both tower and sectors and could utilize either one. So in contrast, if a phone is up closer towards St. Anthony in the red and it doesn't have that overlapping coverage, it doesn't see that tower to the southwest, so it wouldn't be able to interact with the network on that tower and sector.
Can you explain what's on slide 13?
So just like we looked at with the cellular mapping, this is looking at how I'm going to map Google location data. So starting on the left side, you'll see three different icons. So what that represents is two different icons, Wi-Fi and GPS. So as a part of mapping with this case, anything that was greater than 100 meters margin of error, I didn't map for these particular reports. So because of that, there was no cellular data that was 100 meters or less margin of error. So that's why there's not a cellular icon up there. Below that, you'll see the yellow circle. Basically, that's how I'm going to represent the margin of error. So the center point of a particular GPS or Wi-Fi location, and then the margin of error, say it's 30 meters. So from the center of that yellow circle, the radius of 30 meters going out from the center point, that's how that's represented. So that yellow circle would be representative of the margin of error. Looking at the call-out box, similar to the phone previously, what you're looking at is the date and time, the device tag, and that's basically going to associate it with a particular phone that is connected to the Google account, the latitude and longitude, and then the margin of error is going to be that R and then the number following it. So you see there R14, that means there's a 14 meter margin of error associated with that particular data line. And then at the bottom, with Google, we can see a lot of data points in a short amount of time. So in order to put those on a map, it can get extremely cluttered. So typically what I would do is if I had, say, 25 different locations on a particular map, I would put a summary box. And what that's going to do is tell you what types of records I'm summarizing there at the source, whether it's Wi-Fi, cell, or GPS, and then the number of records and the margin of error associated with them. So for instance, if you were to see Wi-Fi 26, that means there's 26 Wi-Fi records that I'm representing on that particular page, and then that the margin of error is 17 to 135 meters for those.
Can you explain what's on page 14?
These are all addresses that were provided to me that were of significance to the investigation. So when you see them on the map, you're going to see them basically with the icon associated with that particular location.
Okay. Is that the same thing on page 15?
It is the same, and I'll make a secondary note too, because there's a note at the bottom of the previous page that you just showed. basically what that indicates is that if there are locations that are very close in proximity, to put them both on a map, you might see one icon overlap the other. So because of that, I just made a note that I'm only going to put the specific icon associated with one of them, but there could technically be two, which I'll make mention of later if that becomes relevant.
Agent, before we continue, we've been talking about location data. And when we're talking about the location, what specific item are we talking about the location of?
When you're talking about these icons?
No. You know, Sorry. Let me rephrase my question. That was confusing. I apologize. I want to talk about some of the limitations of what we're going to be looking at. Are you able to place a phone in a specific person's pocket?
No.
Okay. So you're able to look at records of who you believe a phone is attributable to, correct?
That's correct.
But you don't specifically put it in their pocket.
No, and that's a common theme, I think, that's said a lot. You know, whenever we're doing these records, I'm looking at the location of the phone. I'm not looking at the location of a person. Evidence might indicate later to us that a particular phone was in a particular person's hands. But whenever I'm doing this mapping, I'm mapping the location of a phone, not a person.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I'm going to go over some of the events and some of the things you found on September 9th of 2019. Can you tell the jury what you see on and what you mapped out on page 19?
So this was looking at the Google location history associated with a Google account of homerjmaximus@gmail.com. So the way that Google identifies an account, just like your cellular carrier is going to identify your account based in part on your phone number, Google is primarily going to identify account by that gmail.com address.
Do you know who homerjmaximus@gmail.com, do you know who that email account belonged to?
I reviewed Google the account? Subscription sheet associated with the Gmail account, and it came back to Alex Cox.
Okay, thank you. If you can continue to explain what's on page 19.
So you'll see a trend because there's several pages that potentially are going to be shown, and just so you're familiar with the structure of the report. At the top, what you're typically going to see is what I'm mapping, whether that be an interaction with a cellular network or Google location. So that's kind of the Google location history that's explaining what it's going to be. Below that, you're typically going to see the account, whether it's an account or a specific phone number that we're looking at, and then the time range that a particular map is providing an overview of. So specifically, this is looking at September the 9th, 2019, from midnight until 5 a.m. So again, when I talked about the mapping for Google location history, I did not map anything that was greater than 100 meters. So when we're looking at this, we're looking at three locations that were repeated on all three occasions at 2:42 and 2 seconds, 2:42 and 11 seconds, and then 3:37 and 22 seconds. This is Google location points based on GPS that were directly northwest of Lori Vallow's apartment.
And I'm going to stop you really quick. Would it be helpful for you to use a pointer to show the jury specifically what it is you're talking about?
Yes, it would.
Thank you.
So this is what I'm looking at for.
Sorry.
That's what I just talked about first, was those three locations. And then looking at from 4:37 until 4:41, there's additional Google location points. Again, a repeat of the same points, but showing a 37-meter margin of error that would be consistent with the phone being at Alex Cox's residence.
Okay, and I know we went over a legend earlier, but just as we get into this to aid the jury, there is an AC in that bigger yellow circle, correct?
Correct. And so you'll see down on the bottom left, that's going to usually show the legend of the specific locations that we're looking at. Only to include the full address would, again, create cover up the map, per se. So those addresses are all in the legend on the previous pages. But what you're looking at is just the icons that are represented down here in the legend.
And so, Agent, in the the upper left-hand box with that explanation. Can you just briefly state again what it is we're seeing in terms of that data?
Yes, so you're seeing locations that reported to Google between 242 and then 337, indicating that the device reporting to Google was just northwest of Lori Vallow's apartment.
And so that would be a device that signed into this homerjmaximus@gmail.com?
Correct. That would be a device that the user associated with that account has opted in for location data on that specific device.
Okay. So on the night of September 9th, and we won't necessarily go into detail so much detail on each slide, but just so that we're tracking, on the night of September 9th, that device was just northwest of Lori Vallow's apartment.
Correct, and I would say the early morning hours.
Or, thank you.
That semantics.
Yes. But. No, that's the more accurate way to say it. Thank you. Agent, did you ever track or find other times when a device signed into Homer J. Maximus was located at Lori Vallow's apartment between the hours of 12 and 5 or in the middle of the night?
I did. I looked at the time period from, I believe, August 1st until October 31st, and there were, I believe it was less than 10, but there were other times other than this specific date and time where the device reported a margin of error that was small enough to be consistent with it being at Lori Vallow's apartment.
Okay, thank you. Was there anything else on this slide that was significant to you in your investigation?
I'll add one more piece just because the arrow will be recurring throughout. Anytime you see an arrow, that doesn't indicate that that's the specific pathway that a device took to travel between two points. I'm just simply showing that we have an earlier time from 242 to 337, and then there's the later time of 437 to 441. So basically just to show that arrow to indicate that the device moved that direction during that time period.
Can you explain what's of significance on page 20?
So this is looking at the first time that you're seeing at least cellular records mapped onto a map depicting a particular area. So again, if we start at the top, we're looking at two different numbers, the number ending 0143 and 4652, during the time period of September 9th from 7:20 in the morning until 8:04. You're seeing Chad Daybell's residence represented here in green with CD. Lori Vallow's residence represented down here. This is a good example to say, too, where I don't have an icon for Alex Cox's residence, but that's because if I were to place it, they're so close in proximity that they would overlap each other. And then we're looking at the location of the BYU library. So over here, again, if you want to see which particular color is represented from the particular interaction with the network, we see that 4652 is represented in blue. And then up here, we see 0143 is represented in orange. And then you're looking at the summary of the activity that took place on each one of those towers and sectors. So on the 0143 number, we see several incoming and outgoing SMS messages with 4652 utilizing this tower and sector, which would provide coverage to Chad Daybell's residence. And then we see a call that is between 0143 and 4652. Down here, we see the other side of that call, where 4652 is receiving that call from 0143, utilizing a tower and sector that provides coverage down in Rexburg.
Okay, and can you remind the jury, the number 515-402-0143, who has that been attributed to?
I had that attributed to Chad Daybell.
And the other number, 480-489-4652, who has that been attributed to?
I had that attributed to Lori Vallow.
Okay. And so on the morning of September 9th, 2019, between 7:20 and 8:04, there are multiple communications between those devices?
That's correct.
Okay. Can you explain what's of significance on page 21?
Yes. So what we're seeing, again, the summary at the top, I'll only mention this one more time because then it might be redundant, but we're looking at tower interactions with the network between 9120 and 9374 at 8:11 in the morning. So this is a call made by 9374 utilizing this tower and sector, which would provide coverage to Chad Daybell's residence, to contact 9120. And this is showing the other side of that call where it's receiving it as an incoming, utilizing a tower and sector, which would provide coverage to Rexburg to include Lori Vallow and Alex Cox's apartments, respectively.
Okay. And again, those numbers, can you tell the jury who they're attributable to?
Yes. So I had 9120 being attributed to Alex Cox, and then 9374 being attributed to Chad Daybell.
So is it a fair summary to say that there was a 180-second or 3-minute conversation between those two devices?
That is correct.
The morning of September 9th at 8:11.
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but yes, that is correct.
That's okay. What is of significance to you on page 22?
So this is looking at three different towers and sectors that are being utilized by the 0143 phone. And the different activity is shown in each of the call boxes. So this is an outgoing text to 4652. This is an incoming SMS from an unidentified number. And this is an outgoing and incoming SMS, both with 4652. So when we're looking at this, we're seeing three different towers and sectors that are being utilized within about a 51 minute time frame.
And why is, what does that mean to you as an analyst of these type of records?
So one of the things that I talked about earlier is looking at where we estimate that a phone could be based on tower and sector usage. So anytime we see usage between towers and sectors that are a vast distance apart, what I would anticipate is that the phone, especially when you're looking at, you know, 8:58 and 9:05, that's less than 7 minutes apart. So what I would anticipate based on my training and experience is that since we're utilizing towers and sectors that are vast distance apart, there's going to be an overlapped coverage area between those two, that within that 7 minute window, you couldn't feasibly drive from down here all the way up to Parker within that less than 7 minute window. So the phone would need to be within that, somewhere near the overlapping coverage area. And the closer that is in time, so say for instance, you use one tower and sector and then 30 seconds later, you use a different one, you're going to be, my estimate would be, you're much closer to that overlapping coverage area.
Okay, and just briefly, can you so there's three interaction boxes there, correct?
That's correct.
And in that first one, again, the 0143 number, who is that attributable to?
Chad Daybell.
And the 4652 that it's that number's communicating with, who is that attributable to?
Lori Vallow.
Okay. And the box on the right, can you just briefly go over what those interactions are and who those phones are attributable to?
Yep. So it's one text message being sent by Chad Daybell 0143 and one being received by Chad Daybell 0143. Both of those interactions are with the number ending 4652, which would be attributed to Lori Vallow.
Are you familiar with on that bottom box to the left, the number 288-15-685?
So I'm not familiar what that number is, but I would point out that it's not 10 digits. So typically you can see, like a lot of times you'll get a text message and it won't be from a true number. It might be like a service type thing that you receive on your phone. So again, I don't know without looking into it, but I would just basically take notice that it's not 10 digits to be a true phone number.
In light of what you were just testifying about, what's the significance of page 23?
So this is where I talked about where we can represent coverage areas and overlapping coverage areas. So if you're looking the tower here, the coverage area, and it's only going to be the coverage area, not the dominant area. That coverage area is represented by the red. The tower here, that tower and sector is represented by the green. And then the tower and sector on the southwest part of the map is represented by the yellow. So then what you can see is the overlapping coverage area, and when it goes onto a screen, it doesn't necessarily show it as clear. But what you're looking at is that orange area is the overlapping coverage area. So what that means is that if you were to see records 30 seconds apart, utilizing all three of these different towers and sectors, I would anticipate that that phone would be somewhere close to one of these orange coverage areas, because in order for it to have those interactions, it has to be within the footprint of that tower and sector.
Okay. What did you map on page 25?
So this is looking at, again, mapping some of the Google location history. So we're looking at 8:49 to 9:15 approximately, showing that at 8:49 and 19 seconds, the account associated with Homer J. Maximus at Gmail, which we attributed to Alex Cox, that phone is reporting to Google a location down in the area of his apartment. And then at 9:15 and 43 seconds, that phone is now reporting a location just south of Chad Daybell's residence.
And what is the margin of error on those?
So the one down here on the bottom, you can see the R8, which means 8 meters margin of error, and then R3 on the one on the top, meaning 3 meters margin of error.
Okay. And again, the arrow doesn't mean that's specifically the path followed, correct?
That's correct. It's basically just representing that this preceded this locate down here preceded the one at the top.
Okay, thank you. What did you map on page 26?
So again, this is mapping location history for Homer J. Maximus attributed to Alex Cox for the time period of 9:21 and 36 seconds to 10:57 and 3 seconds. And this is mapping any point that I saw in the Google location history that was of 100 meters or less. And so what that gave is 4 location records that indicated where Google believed this device was during the specific times on the called out boxes.
Can you specifically point out those times and the margins of error with those?
Sure. So the first one that we see is at 9:21, which is a 6 meter margin of error. And that's going to be represented by this smaller circle here. I realize the other one is over top of it. The next one that we see is at 9:22 and 50 seconds, which is going to be up here by a gate into the Daybell property. And that's a 3 meter margin of error. Then we're going to see at 10:39, this 43 larger circle margin of error, which is where the Google location is indicating that the device is basically a 43-meter margin of error in the backyard. And then we see at 10:57 and 3 seconds a 5-meter margin of error, which is plotted just south of a location that I was provided for the burn pit.
Okay. And can you I see that you've got your legend labeled. But for benefit of the jury, can you point out where each of those labels are located on that map?
Sure. So Chad Daybell's residence is represented in green here with CD. The location of Tylee Ryan's body is here, which is represented by TY in red. And then BP is the burn pit, which is just southeast of where Tylee Ryan was located.
Okay.
Mr. Wood, I think we're at about time we ought to consider breaking for the day.
Okay.
I don't know if that was a good breaking point or you had a few more
questions. That's just fine with the state.
Okay. I appreciate that. All right. We will call it a day then and be back in the morning at 8:30. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, thank you again for your jury service. I will advise you, as I have each day, upon concluding trial for the day, please make every effort to not discuss this case amongst yourselves or with anyone else. Please don't do any investigation into the case while you're on the break for the night. Please don't follow any of it on the news or look it up on the internet in any way. And I appreciate you every day following that instruction. It's very important to the case, and the parties as well as the court appreciate your continued adherence to that. So with that in mind, we adjourn for the day and plan on starting again with further testimony at 8:30 in the morning.
All right, please.
That wraps up segment number 4 of our continuous coverage in the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell here on the 24th of April of 2023. There is much more to come. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our courtroom coverage, breaking updates, and discussions on the case as it develops. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.
This is continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
Continuous coverage.
In the trial of Lori Vallow Daybell from the Hidden Killers Podcast.
Hidden Killers Podcast.
It's Cybersecurity Awareness Month. LifeLock is here with tips to help protect your identity. Use strong passwords, set up multi-factor authentication, report scams, and update your software. And for comprehensive identity protection, LifeLock is your best choice. LifeLock alerts you to suspicious uses of your personal information and fixes identity theft, guaranteed, or your money back. Start your protection today with a 30-day free trial at LifeLock.com. Use promo code NEWS. Terms apply.